Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents On the Couch, Writers Analyze Sigmund Freud, by Siri Hustvedt, Andre Assaman, Jennifer Finney Boylan, Alex Phoebe, and Colm Tobin. Edited by Andrew Blauner. Read by Perry Daniels and Dina Perlman. Preface. In his poem In Memory of Sigmund Freud, written shortly after Freud's death in 1939, the poet W. H. Auden described Freud as a whole climate of opinion under whom we conduct our differing lives. Freud, the father of psychiatry, the pioneer of psychoanalysis, is the figure we associate with such concepts as transference, the Oedipus complex, repression, the unconscious, and a model of psychic structure comprising id, ego, and superego. Many consider his writings from the interpretation of dreams to civilization and its discontents among the classics of Western literature. He is also a polarizing figure, sometimes portrayed as a cartoonish persona, a caricature, with controversial ideas about women and sex. His story is one that many people think they know. To his defenders and detractors alike, however, his influence on 20th century thought is undeniable. In this book, 25 writers engage with Freud and his legacy in a variety of ways. I invited them to analyze the great analyst, to reflect on who he was, why he did what he did, and the impact he made. Together they present a reassessment of one of the most important and controversial figures in our history. The pieces are loosely organized by theme. The essays in Interpretations examine Freud through a particular critical lens. Some writers discuss their own encounters with Freud's ideas, while others consider Freud's work in relation to works by others. The Talking Cure collects essays that focus on psychoanalysis and related topics. Personal History provides different perspectives on Freud's personal history, including reflections by some of his descendants. The final section, After Freud, addresses Freud's legacy and influence on literature, on science, and on the authors of these essays in the 20th and 21st centuries. The contributors embrace a wide range of perspectives, from the skeptical to the appreciative. I hope that the book leaves you with a sense of Freud as a fully realized person, not an anachronism or a punchline, but instead a gateway to better understanding ourselves, one another, and our world. Andrew Blauner.
Interpretations. It's complicated. Sarah Boxer. Freud is family, my family. Not literally, but dreamily. I first awakened to Sigmund Freud's presence in my crib. When I was a year old or so, just lying there, my father approached me. I saw him walk toward me from the hallway. He stuck his pointed finger through the bars and said, "Bite." And I, toothless, did bite. Nothing weird, right? In retrospect, though, this innocent scene seems kind of kinky. Thank you, Sigmund Freud, for warping my very first memory. On the other hand, thank you, Sigmund Freud, for putting me in a class with Leonardo da Vinci. As I learned much later, Leonardo had a similar remembrance, which he recounted in the Codex Atlanticus. It comes to my mind as a very early memory when I was still in the cradle. A vulture came down to me. He opened my mouth with his tail and struck me a few times with his tail against my lips. Freud loved this vulture memory so much that he wrote a book about it, Leonardo da Vinci, A Memory of His Childhood, in which he said, "Leonardo's fantasy conceals nothing more or less than a reminiscence of nursing or being nursed at the mother's breast." And when Leonardo grew up, his infant vision became a passive homosexual fantasy. In the house where I grew up, everything had meaning. Unconscious meaning, double meaning, hidden meaning, manifest meaning, latent meaning. Thanks to Freud, nothing was what it seemed. The finger might well be a phallus or a bird. The mouth, toothless, might be a threatening abyss. Hakuna Matata? Never. Vagina dentata? Could be. My dad had a shelf of Freud's writings, which he applied liberally to our lives. He labeled his wife's and his daughter's emotional outbursts hysterical. They weren't. We were trained to be on the lookout for unconscious motives, always there. We were schooled in sussing out the latent criticism behind remarks, jokes, even compliments. We're not paranoid, we're realists. When I took up rock climbing, I was diagnosed with a death wish. No dream went unanalyzed. No gift horse's mouth went unlooked in. My childhood was a world of fizz and buzz, toil and trouble. Anyone who didn't see all this stuff churning under the surface of everyday life was a damn fool. By age 16, I began to grapple with Freud's writings. Looking for a topic for an English paper, I ran my finger along my father's Freud shelf, as if shopping for clothes on a discount rack. I grazed the paperbacks, Beyond the Pleasure Principle, The Interpretation of Dreams, Moses and Monotheism, The Future of an Illusion Civilization and Its Discontents, finally landing on one, untouched and thin, that pleased my eye and my ear, The Ego and the Id. It wasn't really the best choice. I liked the exotic title, but the insides were a scientistic mess. At the kitchen table, I pored over Freud's incomprehensible diagram of ego, id, repressed, accoused, PCPT-Cs, and PCs, staring at the menagerie of terms, some abbreviated, some in italics, some in all caps. Only crazy people use all caps, all linked together by an oval representing a brain. Then something on the next page caught my eye. Freud noted that the ego sported a little cap of hearing, an acoustic helmet, and wore it awry. How jaunty! At this point, Freud plunged into one of his best metaphors. The ego, in its relation to the id, is like a man on horseback who has to hold in check the superior strength of the horse. Often a rider, if he is not to be parted from his horse, is obliged to guide it where it wants to go. So in the same way, the ego is in the habit of transforming the id's will into action, as if it were its own. I was hooked. Freud's jockey metaphor won me over. I wrote my English paper on the ego and the id, or, as Bruno Bettelheim later renamed it, the I and the it. I had no idea what I was talking about. I got an A because the teacher couldn't understand what I was talking about either. By the time I went to college, Freud was largely passé, at least at Harvard. The only Freud book I read there, Three Theories on Sexuality, was for a course on intellectual history. Meanwhile, the Harvard Department of Psychology and Social Relations was, as far as I could tell, populated by sadists. Lurking somewhere in that department was the behaviorist B.F. Skinner, the king of controlled environments. So-called Skinner boxes, where pigeons, rats, and even people were coaxed by positive and negative reinforcements to do whatever they were conditioned to do. I never took a psychology course. It all seemed god-awful. Nonetheless, I came pretty close to being a part of that world when I interviewed for a summer job in the Harvard lab of Torsten Wiesel and David Eubel, who were already famous and soon to be Nobel famous, for their work on the visual processing systems of kittens. Now they were moving on to monkeys. The job I interviewed for was taking care of the monkeys. But when I found out that the new experiment entailed forcing monkeys, heads immobilized, to stare at a visual stimulus for hours on end every day for the rest of their lives, lives that would end with a beheading and an analysis of what all that torture had done to their brains, I bailed. As I left the lab, Wiesel told me that although the monkeys' lives would not be pleasant and would inevitably end with a decapitation, at least their lives will be a little better if you care for them. Was he guilt-tripping me? I fled psychology, psychiatry, and every associated field, but not forever. I moved to New York and found work as a science journalist. I had roommates. I had boyfriends. I had problems. I needed therapy. So once I finally managed to earn a living wage with benefits, I went looking for a therapist. I tried many, I rejected many. Finally, one stuck. He was a Freudian. He told me I'd have to kill a dozen shrinks before finding the right one. I think he was number 6 or so. He was older than my dad. He walked crookedly, like he was about to fall over. He had a sense of humor, but I worried that he was a crackpot. Once a week, I went into his darkened room and lay on a couch and talked. He often steered the conversation to rage. When I looked into his background many years later, I learned that he had a horribly tragic history, captured in the 1984 movie Bay Boy. His parents were murdered in their home in 1941 by an anti-Semitic policeman who lived in the building they owned. No wonder my therapist was examining my rage. I'd be examining my rage, too, if I were him, which didn't mean that I didn't have any. Anyway, psychoanalysis was not dead, at least not to me. I resumed my Freud reading, the interpretation of dreams, and kept a dream journal. Then, in the late 1980s, while enjoying a brief period of unemployment and some severance pay from Time, Inc., I moved to Berkeley and started doodling. I daydreamed and I drew. Maybe I could start a comic strip. I'd always drawn a bunny, and he always looked troubled to me. I tried to get him to talk and move. He wouldn't. I placed him in a bar and got him drunk to see whether he'd talk. No. Then, suddenly, a light bulb. This bunny was totally neurotic. Why not send him to a psychoanalyst? He desperately needed help. Thus, Bunny Man, my neurotic superhero, was born. And he quickly found a quack analyst, a bird, Dr. Sigbird Floyd. In the mold of Dr. Freud, Dr. Floyd, the bird analyst, was only interested in Bunny Man's psychic life. Although Bunny Man came running to Dr. Floyd because he was being chased by a wolf, Dr. Floyd assured Bunny Man that the wolf was just a fantasy. But then, at the end of the very first episode, just as Bunny Man left the safe haven of Dr. Floyd's office, a wolf walked in the door for his own analysis with Dr. Floyd. It was Mr. Wolfman. This was how my first comic, In the Floyd Archives, A Psycho-Bestiary, began. To research my comic, I dove deep into Freud's case histories. I studied the Wolfman and Daniel Paul Schreiber, who would merge to form some of the details of my bipolar cross-dressing Wolfman, the Rat Ma'am, who would become my obsessive-compulsive hoarder, Rat Ma'am, Dora, who would become Lambskin, the fleece that was sometimes worn by the cross-dressing Wolfman, and Little Hans, who would become my edible star, Bunny Man. By the time my comic really took shape in the 1990s, I had a new job as an editor at the New York Times Book Review. There, I was in charge of all books about science, nature, psychology, and psychoanalysis. Dumpster-sized containers full of books came in every week. I got to decide which ones would get reviewed and who should review them, and then I would edit the reviews. For a few books, On Kissing, Tickling, and Being Bored, by the child analyst Adam Phillips being one, I did the reviewing myself. One of my first and scariest editing assignments was handling the review of Final Analysis, The Making and Unmaking of a Freudian Analyst, 1990, by Jeffrey Musayef Masson, who was infamous for his battles with psychoanalysis. In the 1970s, Masson, a charming and dogged Sanskrit scholar, who was also a psychoanalyst in training, befriended the founder of the Freud Archives, Kurt Eisler, as well as Freud's daughter, Anna Freud, keeper of her father's flame. Shockingly, the two of them handed Masson the keys to the psychoanalytic kingdom in 1980. Masson was named the project director of the Freud Archives and thereby gained access to all of Freud's letters and interviews. Eisler came to regret it, bitterly. When Eisler died in 1999, I wrote his obituary and quoted what Gwen Davis had written about him in The Nation. Eisler was like old Geppetto, who had carved himself a son, only to discover to his profound chagrin that Pinocchio was a naughty boy. Once Masson had access, beginning in the early 1980s, to Freud's letters, he zoomed in on what he considered the most scandalous and amoral turn in Freud's life, his abandonment of the so-called seduction hypothesis. In 1895, Freud wrote a letter to his friend Wilhelm Fliess, stating his belief that all neurosis was caused by child abuse. Then, less than a year later, Freud scaled back his hypothesis, arguing that some neuroses might be caused by the fantasy that one had been abused. In a 1983 New Yorker essay titled Trouble in the Archives, the journalist Janet Malcolm described the revision. Freud never doubted that seductions and rapes and beating of children sometimes do take place, she wrote. But he came to believe that many or most of the seductions reported by his patients were wishful fantasies. To orthodox Freudians, this shift away from historical reality toward so-called psychic reality was the very key to psychoanalysis. To Masson, it was a horrible abandonment of abused children and a disaster for psychoanalysis. In her New Yorker piece, Malcolm quoted Masson's 1981 address to the Western New England Psychoanalytic Society, in which he damned Freud's revision. By shifting the emphasis from a real world of sadness, misery, and cruelty to an internal stage on which actors performed invented dramas for an invisible audience of their own creation, Freud began a trend away from the real world that, it seemed to me, has come to a dead halt in the present-day sterility of psychoanalysis throughout the world. Masson was promptly removed from his throne at the Freud Archives, and then he had a royal tantrum that lasted years. By the time I handled the review of his 1990 book, Final Analysis, in which he chronicled his own terrible psychoanalysis and his ejection from the Freud Archives, his anti-therapy rampage was famous. He had already written two other books against psychoanalysis, The Assault on Truth, 1984, detailing his case against Freud, and Against Therapy, 1988, arguing that abuse of one form or another is built into the very fabric of psychotherapy. Most ominously, to me, he had sued The New Yorker in 1984 for Janet Malcolm's reportage about him, which had become in 1983 a book, In the Freud Archives. His case went all the way to the Supreme Court, where he ultimately lost. Even after I left the New York Times Book Review to become an arts and ideas reporter at the Times, psychoanalysis remained one of my regular beats. In 1997, I wrote a piece titled How Oedipus is Losing His Complex, and an article on the history of hysteria. In 1998, I wrote about poopophobia, the fear of puppets, and also covered the heated debate among psychoanalysts about Freud's abandonment of his seduction hypothesis. By the late 1990s, when the so-called Freud Wars had reached a fever pitch, I was embedded more or less with the Freudian troops. I understood their lingo and seemed to care more than anyone I knew on the Times staff about the past and future of psychoanalysis. I felt it was my duty to report honestly about the Freud Wars from the front. Nonetheless, I had plenty of doubts about Freud and his methods. The comic I was drawing made hay of Freud's mania for fantasy over reality. I had also modeled the most sinister character in my book, Dr. Fliess, who threatens Lambskin with a fleecing, on Freud's quackiest friend, Wilhelm Fliess. But despite my skepticism, I felt no kinship with the anti-Freudians. They struck me as humorless, petty, and mean. On December 17, 1995, for instance, I reviewed Paul Rosen's book, How Freud Worked, First-Hand Accounts of Patients. His main point was that Freud had no boundaries with his patients, which sure seemed true. Among Freud's analysands were his own daughter, his daughter's friend, his translator, and his caregiver. As I noted in my review, He was personable to the point of being meddlesome and indiscreet. He was more than willing to ask favors of his patients and give them advice, and he vacationed, played cards, and spoke unguardedly with his favorites. But when I, after agreeing with Rosen's main argument, took issue with his tendentious quotation marks and his questionable logic, finding his book a minefield of shattered quotes and non sequiturs, he sent me hate mail. And when a new Italian translation of the book came out, he sent me jauntier hate mail. By the end of the 20th century, Freud's attackers seemed to have gained the upper hand in the Freud wars. At the New York Review of Books, the critic Frederick Cruz often published long essays on Freud's faults, which he then collected in a 1995 book titled The Memory Wars, Freud's Legacy in Dispute. And when, in 1995, the Library of Congress first announced plans for an exhibition on Freud's legacy, the anti-Freudians, so the rumor went, managed to get the show postponed until a more critical take on Freud could be found. 3 years later, in 1998, when Sigmund Freud, Conflict and Culture, finally did open, the Freud basher seemed to have won some concessions. As I wrote in a 1998 essay for The Times, when verbal resists visual, Freud's defense against art, the exhibition's greatest claim for Freud was merely an irrefutable and obvious point. Freud, like it or not, has had an extraordinary influence on our culture, from Thurber to Popeye. Still, a lot of Freud's bashers were unhappy. They seethed that such a man got to be honored with such a show in such a venue. As the British historian and philosopher John Forrester put it in his 1998 book, Dispatches from the Freud Wars, Freud's harshest critics had a heartfelt wish that Freud might never have been born or, failing to achieve that end, that all his works and influence be made as nothing. Were the bashers going to get their way? Was the ship of Freud sinking? Were there any lifeboats? Could psychoanalysis be saved? The Freudians seemed to be on their heels. I wanted to know what would happen, so I gathered all the Freud-bashing books I could find and reviewed them in an essay for the New York Times Book Review, Flogging Freud, August 10, 1997. My tone was fairly breezy, as if team psychoanalysis would sail on no matter what, with a cigar-smoking Freud on its prow. Freud has proved to be a great whipping boy for our time. He has been blamed for turning children against their parents, Frederick Cruz, and for excusing parents who seduce their children, Jeffrey Masson, for being a cryptobiologist, Frank Selloway, and a crypto-priest, Richard Webster, for believing patients too little, Jeffrey Masson, and too much, Mikkel Bork Jacobsen, for hiding his faults, Henry Ellenberger, and flaunting them, John Farrell. But deep down, I was worried. Freud wasn't exactly my personal hero, but he was, after all, family. At the height of the Freud wars, I was putting the finishing touches on my spoof of Freud's case histories in the Floyd Archives, A Psycho Bestiary, 2001. By this time, my main characters were so closely tied to Freud's famous patients, the Wolfman, the Ratman, Dora, Schreiber, and Little Hans, that I felt compelled to add some 75 endnotes to my comic, and I decided to name my book after, in the Freud Archives, Malcolm's book about Masson's undermining of the Freud Archives. My comic was neither tribute nor hatchet job. It was Freudian. I turned Freud's ideas on themselves, sometimes making fun of them. In one review titled An Analytic Casebook Full of Animal Instincts, New York Times, September 6, 2001, the playwright Jenny Lynn Bader wrote, "If Freud had a bad dream, it would probably be Floyd." Fair enough. Freud's case histories, his most vivid and dramatic material, captivated me, but I knew they were treacherous territory. In the Wolfman case, Freud totally overreached in claiming to know with certainty what his patient really had seen as an infant and how it affected him. Was the Wolfman's dream of wolves silently sitting in a tree really proof that as an infant he saw his parents having sex doggy style? And the infamous Dora case was Freud at his worst. This was ground zero for no means yes, when Dora, a teenager, told Freud that his old friend, Herr K., had tried to seduce her. Freud demurred, saying that her report merely showed her wish to be seduced by Herr K., and by Freud, too. Talk about unexamined projection. In dealing with this infuriating and almost absurdly awful material, and by the way, Herr K. later confessed to Dora, I still was awed by Freud's ability to be both maddeningly literal-minded and beautifully metaphorical in almost the same breath, his talent with puns and slips, and his great ease with unconscious life. Sometimes he used his gifts atrociously, but what gifts they were! I won't say that the Freud archives ended the Freud wars, but I will say that the Freud wars ended abruptly and dramatically on the day of what was supposed to be my first New York book party for Freud, originally scheduled for September 11, 2001. Needless to say, the party was canceled. On that day, the Freud wars came to a screeching halt. Freud was worse than dead. He was totally beside the point. Who cared about psychological reality when actual reality, airliners used as weapons, collapsing towers, 3,000 dead, a smoke-filled city, the threat of future terrorism, was so clearly present? However, not everyone got the memo. To some people, or at least those who attended my book talks, Freud still mattered. At one of my talks for In the Freud Archives, a few audience members voiced outrage that I was using Freud's ideas at all. Someone asked, If Freud has been discredited, why would you spend so much time on him? Another asked, If Freud hated women so much, why would you, a woman, pay him any mind? I was on the defensive. I imagine I said something unwitty about Freud's wit. Closer to home, I faced opposite challenges. From Freudians and psychoanalytically inclined persons, including some from my family, came questions about the critical tone of In the Freud Archives. Why do you mock Freud? At a meeting of the American Psychoanalytic Association, I had a little friendly back and forth with Harold Blum, who had become the executive director of the Freud Archives in 1986, after Masson was fired from that post. In a conversation called Dr. Freud and Dr. Freud, Blum and I compared what was in the Freud archives with what was in the Freud archives. Apparently, I was still welcome among the psychoanalysts, but I could tell that my audience, battered and bruised by the Freud wars and September 11th, was in no mood for Freudian fun and games. Everyone with a psychoanalytic bent wanted to know what my real attitude toward Freud was. Once again, I was on the defensive. If I recall correctly, my answers boiled down to one rhetorical question. Wasn't I honoring Freud by engaging him, playing with him, fighting him on the very playground that he himself built? I'm not sure anyone bought it. Several years later, I wrote and drew a sequel to the Freud archives titled Mother May I, A Post-Freudian Folly. There I played with some of the wild ideas that Freud formulated at the end of his life, the father-fearing, father-killing, father-worshipping foundations of civilization, as he outlined them in Totem and Taboo and Moses and Monotheism, as well as some of the mother-centric ideas of the post-Freudians, namely the breast-obsessed object relations theory of Melanie Klein and the play therapy of Donald Winnicott. My new comic turned out to be a much broader comedy than the Freud archives. So, when international psychoanalytic books wanted to publish Mother May I, along with a new edition of Freud, I was both pleased and surprised. In Mother May I was as tough on late Freud and the post-Freudians as I had been on early Freud in my first book. By turning Melanie Klein, the great analyst of rage and envy, into an intrusive and bossy little sheep named Melanin Klein, which means little
Sample complete. Ready to continue?